Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Dr. Pettus Perry. I'll be flying solo today as Jill has this Sunday off, but I have lots of questions for our guests to keep us busy during the show. Our program today is, can police move from a warrior mentality to one of guardianship? Authoritarianism is antithetical to democracy. The January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol, the invasion of Ukraine, and the militarizing of police in many of our cities are living examples of authoritarianism in action. Are there any similarities between them? We'll find out in a little bit as we talk to our guests. Our two interview guests today, Dr. William Binet, creator of Polarities of Democracy Theory, and Dr. Joseph McMillan, former president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, or NOBLE, say yes. They say residents often feel as though the police are an occupying force rather than helpful servants of the people in their communities. This must change. Our future depends on it. Welcome to Be Bold America, Joe. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Our Be Bold guests today are two leaders in the field. Dr. Joseph McMillan has a doctorate in criminal justice. He is an Institute of Polarities of Democracy Fellow, a member of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Police Executive Research Foundation, and the American Society of Criminology. And he's a past president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. Dr. Bill Binet is an activist, educator, and researcher who developed the Polarities of Democracy Theory. He has over 50 years in politics and social justice activism. He served 28 years in the Monroe County Legislature in Rochester, New York, including 5 years as its majority leader. They both are here today to discuss how policing can be reimagined to shift police cultures from warrior mentality towards guardianship mindsets. We have big things to do. Hey, Bill, why don't we start with you? Would you share a little bit about how you came up with the history of polarities and why you think they are important? And tell us, you know, what they are and why you think it's important for communities to understand and use them.
Thank you, Pettus. Very quickly, I had spent a lifetime in politics, and while I had many individual successes over the years, my 5 years as majority leader left me with a desire to understand why we were having such difficulty in bringing about systemic changes to address issues of racism, paternalism, all of the vile problems that we have in America and around the world that are preventing our progress as a human species. I became convinced through my research that democracy should be a solution to the problem of oppression. It should be the path to human emancipation and healthy, sustainable, and just communities. But we've never really attained the promise of democracy, either here in America or around the world. And my research helps us to understand why. First, there are 10 essential values for democracy. And those, I'll get to those values in just a minute. But those values, those 10, none of them are sufficient by themselves. And unfortunately, we've been raised mostly to understand either-or solutions to problems. Barry Johnson's polarity thinking allows us to understand that sometimes there are problems that don't get solved because they go on forever, because a dilemma exists, a polarity exists. And when a polarity exists, both poles of that polarity have positive aspects and negative aspects. And we have to leverage that polarity in order to maximize the positives and minimize the negatives. Now, in my theory, because there are five polarities and they're all interrelated, it gets a little more complex. But I think you'll quickly understand that you can't get to democracy unless we get the positive aspects of all five of these pairs: freedom and authority, justice and due process, diversity and equality, human rights and communal obligations, and participation and representation.
That's an amazing concept and theory, and I've been doing some reading on it. Can you talk about some of the practical applications and how this might work in, you know, in the real world, taking it from theory to actual practice?
Yes, the Institute for Polarities Democracy has an entire program that's designed specifically to take the theory and turn it into to practice. How we can work with an organization or work with a community to identify the extent to which they are maximizing the positive aspects of those pairs or failing to by minimizing the negative aspects. And when we get into the specifics relating to policing, I want to turn it over to Joe because he's really the expert in this field. I created the theory and I understand how we apply it, but in individual circumstances, it's going to be applied in different ways depending on what the positives and negatives are being faced by that community. Let me just say one more thing, though, to help you understand the difference between either-or thinking and both-and thinking. If I decide I want to run a marathon, that's a yes or no decision on my part. But as soon as I make that decision, the question of whether or not I will run that marathon rests on a polarity of rest and exercise. And if I only rest, like me, you ain't going to run no exercise, no marathon. But on the other hand, if you only focus on exercise, if you fail to rest and get the restoration that your body needs, you're not running a marathon either. You need to get the best aspects of both of those poles and minimize the negative aspects in order to successfully run that marathon.
Now, this your theory is being deployed globally, if I remember correctly. Am I right?
We do have people all over the world who are beginning to explore and use polarities democracy. I've had about 20 PhD students so far who've completed their research using polarities democracy to apply it to specific social problems. For instance, I had... John Tobor was a student in Nigeria who was looking at the amnesty program in Nigeria to see if they could strengthen the program by application of polarities democracy and make a number of recommendations for changes in public policy that would help to bring that about. Likewise, my student Emmanuel Agbornbai, another Nigerian student, was looking at the problems of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria and how they could address those problems. So, yes, it is being used around the world. I have another student in Sri Lanka using it to try to stop the oppression of Rohingya in Sri Lanka. And there are others around the world that are engaged with polarities democracy in their local specific instances.
Outstanding, Bill. Joe, before we get into policing, how did you meet Bill? How did the two of you come across each other?
Well, first off, thank you very much for having me this evening. I was actually a student at Walden University working on my dissertation and had the pleasure of sitting in a session which Dr. Benet was presenting. And very early on, I saw what he was suggesting as an avenue to address what I was interested in working on for my dissertation, which is how we went about managing firearm homicides amongst youth in urban areas. And it was through that relationship that I met Dr. Benet.
Outstanding. Let's get into some of the policing issues. Would you share with us about the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives? And they got some kudos during the Supreme Court hearings, by the way.
Thank you.
Who are the members? You know, what is its mission? Is NOBLE having any positive impact on changing the way that police work and the culture nationwide?
Thank you very much for that question. Just as a backdrop, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, which is known as NOBLE, was actually founded in 1976 following a symposium that was developed to address crime in low-income urban areas. That symposium brought together about 60 top-ranking Black law enforcement executives representing over 24 states and 50 major cities in the Washington, D.C. area to participate in that exchange. Through the exchange of those views during that symposium, about the criticality of high rates of crime in Black urban communities and the socioeconomic conditions that led to crime and violence. They raised questions about relevant issues during that symposium, such as the fairness in the administration of justice, police community relations, as well as the hiring and promotion of Black police officers and the unique problems of the Black police executive. So that was the formulation of NOBLE. And NOBLE today is known, what we like to say, as the conscience of law enforcement. NOBLE is an organization that brings together representatives from municipalities, states, and federal law enforcement to address those various issues that are confronting our communities across the United States, as well as in some international locations like the Caribbean in the United Kingdom as well.
Outstanding. What are the percentages today of Black and other persons of color as chiefs of police and senior law enforcement officers?
And again, unfortunately, I don't have that statistic, you know, directly in front of me. But I think what you can look at, what I would say, the major cities across the United States, there's been an ebb and a flow where you've had cities with significant minority representation. And then as time has gone on, some of that has dwindled. And recently, in some of our major cities, you saw a significant amount of minority law enforcement executives leading those departments. But unfortunately, I don't have that specific number in front of me right now, so I wouldn't want to give you a quota number at this point.
I appreciate that, and that's quite all right. I want to get one more question in, at least before the break. What's meant when people talk about community policing, and why is that important?
You know, the importance of community policing is, as issues occur in the United States, they cannot be addressed and or tackled singularly by, say, a police department. The community has to be a partner with the police department in those areas to bring about change in those communities. For far often, too many times, organizations or entities might think that they've got the solution to all the problems that are existing within a particular, and carving out those community members, those activists and others who are living those lived experiences in those communities. So to the extent you can embrace and bring the community in for dialogue, embrace, bring the community in for the formulation of policies and procedures on how you're going to police in those communities, that's when you see the value of what's known as community policing.
Outstanding. Jill was actually a manager in the city of San Jose when community policing began to emerge as a way of being. And the city actually won an award for being one of the safest cities in America. And it was attributed to the fact that they were actually using this idea of community policing. So when we get back, we've got to take a break now. But when we get back, I have some more questions for you. So stand by. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. We're speaking with Dr. Joseph McMillan, past president for the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives and a fellow with the Institute of Polarities of Democracy, and Dr. William Binet, who developed the Polarities of Democracy theory and who has over 50 years experience in politics and social activism. I'm your host, Dr. Pettis Perry.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Back to you, Pettis.
Today, our topic is, can police move from a warrior mentality to a guardianship mindset? We're speaking with Dr. Joseph McMillan, past president for the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and Dr. William Binet, who developed the Polarities of Democracy theory. You can learn more at instituteforpolaritiesofdemocracy.org. Getting back to our conversation, Joe, have you noticed a difference in communities where minorities, blacks and other minorities are now in chief of police positions than, let's say, in communities where that doesn't exist? Are the incidents of shootings going down? What are the dynamics that you're seeing?
Again, I don't think you can necessarily bifurcate it currently by any particular ethnic group that's leading the department. I think you're seeing a resurgence of violence in the United States, whether it's in communities that are being led by those that are minority or not. But it's the strategies that are employed in those different cities that you're trying to get your arms around. So, again, when you're looking at what's occurring in the country, what Noble is trying to say is there's a variety of strategies that need to be employed. And clearly, African-American and minority executives have a voice in those communities and should be considered as a part of the implementation and development of strategies to lead those departments. So there have been some successes, but there's still a whole lot of work to be done because of the sheer issues themselves for which we're confronted with. These are complex issues. A lot of times people have looked at crime prevention and strategies, again, singularly that it's only the police chief or only the police department is going to identify the solution. I think over time we've identified that that's not a recipe for success. And when you're integrating concepts like polarities of democracy into that conversation, I think you'll see continued engagement and involvement positively for reducing crime in those communities as we're having those types of conversations.
Yeah, part of my research has been on trauma-informed communities, and I've been listening to the increased violence that's going on in our communities. And just from my own perspective, I've been wondering how much of that is attributed to the mental stress that people are facing in light of COVID. Prior to COVID breaking out in 2020, in fact, in 2019, I started some webinars about trauma-informed communities. And at that point, the National Institutes of Health found in a 2013 study that 90% of the people that they surveyed exhibited or spoke to the fact that they had had at least one major, what they call seismic event, with the norm being multiple. So I'm wondering how much trauma plays into this, and are there things that Noble and other police departments are doing to train their officers around the mental stresses, not only for the communities, but for themselves? Because I think it's at least what I'm hearing out in the public, there seems to be, I don't want to say a disconnect, but there seems like there may be some opportunities to bring mental health workers into this dynamic with police service. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you've actually hit the nail on the head. And I just want to give for clarification and disclosure purposes, I'm not representing Noble this evening. I'm not speaking specifically on behalf of the organization, being a past president. But I'm giving you my perspective as it relates to these issues. So when we're talking about reforming or reimagining policing in America, one of the things, as you just touched on, we're seeing the value is integrating mental health professionals and others into the dynamic of that call for service, possibly. So you're starting to see departments across the country utilizing that approach to addressing a myriad of complex, as I said earlier, myriad of complex issues. So if there's value of having someone with from a social worker or a mental health perspective as a part of that response effort, then you can possibly take that situation maybe from one that might end up being a fatality to one where someone is coached down off of that perch or that ledge that they might be sitting on at that time when the officers arrive at that scene. So as a euphemism, but so there is value in using mental health, using different strategies. And that's what our entire initiative through the Institute was to say there's certain values here that you need to look more holistically. And in our engagement with Noble as a part of its project was what were those different things under 21st century policing, like some of the things you just suggested a minute ago, Pettis, that should be embraced into the implementation strategies themselves.
Outstanding. Just out of curiosity, what's Noble's position on no-knock warrants and stop and frisk and those kinds of policies?
And again, I think from the public statements that are out there, it's up to that local community as to whether or not they're going to support or not support a particular strategy. So as an organization, we feel the organization would feel that there's a time and place for certain techniques to be used and a time and place for certain techniques not to be used. The driver for that has to be that local community. It can't come necessarily from an organization. Now, Noble does have positions, has taken stated positions on things like ensuring that officers cannot traverse from one department to another and not, especially if they were issues at the former departments, and not have some sort of a registry identifying those bad actors. Or no-knock warrants and things of that nature, again, that's left to that local community to make a decision as to what's best for their community.
So if I understand, just want to make sure I heard you correctly. So Noble is supporting a registry?
Yes. You're looking at a variety of things, congressional bills that have been offered, like the Police Act bill and others. One of the things that's been concerning to the industry of policing itself is the ability, if an officer is necessarily disciplined in a jurisdiction, leaving that jurisdiction, going to another area and being employed in the and the current jurisdiction has no knowledge of that prior disciplinary act. Well, there's no registry, current national registry at all right now that kind of tracks that. So that is one of the areas that as an organization, Noble has in fact been supportive of, that there's a need for that type of data, transparent data, to be made available. And it goes again to the heart of some of those different pillars that we were talking about under the 21st Century Policing Report. So you can't have trust and legitimacy in a system where you can't trust the officers that are in that community. So that type of a registry would be advantageous, yes.
Yeah, I agree with what you're talking about. Trust is so important when you're trying to bring communities together. Without trust, you really don't have a basis for true work and people really believing in each other. Well, let me ask this. How is Noble applying the polarities of democracy in its work and the things that it does?
Okay, and thank you very much for that question. Just to give you a little bit of a backdrop, when Dr. Benet and I came together for this current initiative, we actually worked out a memorandum of understanding with Noble as to how we would approach this type of an issue where you're integrating what we can see, like I say, the lens of polarities of democracy, those 10 essential values into the functionings of policing. So one of the things we did is we formulated a grouping. We took the 21st Century Policing Report, which actually came out of the Obama administration around the 2015 timeframe, and looked at it as somewhat of an architectural blueprint, if you would, for what good policing looks like in our country. So a lot of conversation, as you're aware, Pettis, over the last couple of years about relationships in communities and what could and or could not be done, some very unfortunate situations ending in the deaths of citizens. This blueprint, this 21st Century Policing Report, gave us the opportunity as an institute to partner with an organization like Noble and leverage its resources and knowledge of police chiefs and executives and those that are within that organization on what some of these terms and these concepts look like in communities. So we took a very strategic look, analysis-wise, of that 21st Century Policing Report. So what Noble asked us to do initially was to look at three pillars of that report. The report was broken down into six pillars, and they asked us to look at three of those pillars, one being trust and legitimacy, policies and policing, and then community policing and crime reduction. As the project continued on, the organization came back to us and asked us to integrate training and education as well into that conversation of the review and the analysis, which the Institute was able to do on that report. So Noble made its membership available through a variety of surveys that we were able to do at the executive level, as well as its general membership, so that we could get some understanding of certain terminology from the 21st Century Policing Report, as well as identify certain themes that were coming out of that report. And how could the organization then use that information, whether it's for legislative purposes or in communities themselves, to bring communities together to address and make that document a living, breathing document, and something that's not just sitting on a shelf. So the organization Noble has been very active in trying to work with its congressional, at the request of congressional members, at a variety of issues associated with reforming and reshaping policing in America. So there's been a significant amount of testimony that the organization has done, a lot of listening sessions in communities. And now that we've got this part of your work, this is another tool in the toolkit that Noble now has as it goes out into communities to engage communities. They have a very active program known as the Law in Your Community right now. And it's through programs like that, that and bringing others in, that you can see the values of these value sets that Dr. Benet so presciently identified as a part of his research.
Outstanding. Let's see if we can get one more question in. How do you see the polarities of democracy being brought as part of the training or the retraining of police officers? Is it down at the patrol level, or is this still at an administrative level?
No, it's down. I like to say it's down where the goats can get at it. It's just Joe Madison will say it. You've got to get these concepts down to those individuals that are having day-to-day contacts in communities. So whether it is at the academy level, or whether it's at the field training officer level, whether at that squad level, it's got to be that low, because until you can change the dynamic and people and understanding of these values, they have to be a part of the conversation, so that as you're conducting enforcement activities, it's that you're not over-enforcing in areas and doing things that you really should not be doing. It's one thing to have policies and procedures in place, but unless an individual is willing to embrace that as a part of their core being, you will never have change. And the best change comes from the ground up, not necessarily forced from the top down. So it's got to be done, like I said, where the goats can get at it, at that officer level and that trainee level.
That's outstanding. Somebody who studies leadership and organizational behavior, I think you're absolutely correct. You can't bring about change if it only happens at the top. It has to become part of the culture and way of being of the people, inculcated as part of the values, so that people believe in it and will change their behaviors, which is what culture is really about. You're listening to our guests, Dr. William Benet and Dr. Joseph McMillan, and we are discussing how the polarities of democracy theory may be applied to reimagining policing. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America at 22828. That's text Be Bold America at 22828. We'll be right back after this week's Hightower commentary titled A Rube Goldberg Inflationary Spiral. I'm your host, Dr. Pettus Perry.
Last July, several GOP senators combined their 5-watt intellects to charge that inflation was rising because of, quote, insane tax and spending spree of President Biden and the Democrats. Never mind that the insane spending is for such sensible, productive, and enormously popular national needs as child care and jobless benefits. Mitch McConnell's rabidly partisan flock saw the chance to politicize the public's legitimate worries about rising prices. You poor consumers are made to pay more for basics, they squawked, because of Socialist Joe's investment in grassroots people. Follow the ricocheting pinball of the GOP's logic. One, they say that helping hard-hit families induces them to refuse to go to work. Two, this creates blockages in the global supply chain. Three, this causes shortages of everything. Four, this forces corporate bosses to raise all prices. Which, five, slams the middle class and poor. So, six, lazy workers cause inflation. Whoa, Rube Goldberg couldn't have dreamed up a more fantastical diagram to deflect attention from what's really happening. Namely, that instead of an inflation problem, we have a corporate greed problem. Of course, the greedmeisters insist that their pursuit of excess corporate profits has not driven any price surges. In our economy of free market competition, they snap, prices are established by the law of supply and demand. It's the magic of the marketplace, they explain. But magicians don't do magic, they perform illusions. And the illusion of free market competition implodes when it hits the reality that our economy doesn't remotely resemble a competitive marketplace. This is Jim Hightower saying, for some 40 years, corporate-directed government policies have been transforming America into monopoly nation, letting the few gouge the many. That's where inflation comes from. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you lowdowners who subscribe to our monthly newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown. You know who you are. Thank you.
And now back to Be Bold America.
If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Dr. Pettus Perry. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. And we're listening to our two bold guests, Dr. Joseph McMillan, past president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and Dr. William Binet, who developed the Polarities of Democracy theory. Learn more at their website, instituteforpolaritiesofdemocracy.org. Bill, let's bring you into this conversation. You've heard everything that Joe has said. You've got to be a proud papa when you think about the work that Noble is doing. Are there other examples? Well, first, I'd like to hear about your thinking about Noble, but are there also other examples in addition to Noble that you can speak to?
thank you, Pettus. I am terribly proud of the work that Joe has taken on with Noble. That is the most significant work that the Institute has done so far in taking polarities of democracy and helping to address the issues across America. But it is only one component of our anti-racism initiative. And I have to pause for a minute to bring in the whole question of racism and white supremacy. We just had that great editorial by Jim Hightower. Much of the direction that he has pointed out has been brought about over the last 40 years by people with power and privilege using racism and white supremacy as a tool to convince the majority or at least a significant portion of the electorate that the problems are caused by spending. And Lyndon Johnson once said, if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, give him somebody to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. Well, that is a major factor in how they have convinced people, including police officers as well as others, that really it's the social problems of the 60s that are the cause of all of the trouble that we have in America, when it is really corporate policies that have continued to cut taxes for the most wealthy and the corporations, while cutting social programs that have led us to where we are. And so we need to address racism not just through reforming policing. We have to address all of the social problems across America that exist that are causing racial and economic and social disparities that prevent the promise of democracy becoming a reality for all people. Now, in terms of other successes, I'm afraid that I can't point to too many of them yet. We do have a number of initiatives that are aligned with our anti-racism initiative that we're in the process of trying to bring about change. But Noble is the first organization that has signed on with us. The second was Walden University. Now, Joe and I teach at Walden University. Up until today, all of the research that has been done at Walden regarding Polarities and Democracy has been done within the School of Public Policy and Administration. But now we are in the process of rolling out Polarities and Democracy across the entire university, the School of Education, the School of Social Work, School of Human Services, School of Public Health, and School of and all of the other schools within the university. Through that research, it is my belief that in the coming months and years, and the Institute has only been around for a few years, we're in our infancy, we will be able to find those additional organizations that will subscribe to Polarities of Democracy and want to bring it into their organizations. In the meantime, we're looking at organizations out there that are already doing good work that maybe you've never heard yet about Polarities of Democracy, but are on the right track in terms of promoting the kinds of values that we promote, like the NAACP, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and many other organizations that are pursuing that common agenda for democracy.
Outstanding, and congratulations to you and Walden University for expanding the work that's going to be done. Walden has certainly been a leader as a social change institution, so that makes me very happy. And I wish you all well on that part of your work. Now, over the course of this discussion, I've made an assumption that police have a warrior mentality. So let me ask, do police have a warrior mentality or a guardian mentality? And it seems to me that a warrior mentality would see people as other in the psychological sense, as the enemy, and foster a sense of victimhood thinking, and that guardianship mindset would not do that. So, Bill, why don't you? What are your thoughts about something like that?
I'm going to turn most of this over to Joe because he deals with the policing. That's his life, and my history has been politics. But while in this transformation from a warrior to guardian mentality. And I think that far too often, particularly because of the militarization of policing in America, yes, that is the mindset that drives. And yet, we don't want to lose the sense of protection that is part of that warrior mentality. Certainly, on January 6th of 2020, it was essential that those brave men and women in blue in our Capitol defended a democracy and defended the seat of our democracy and prevented the overthrow of our government. But they were also embracing the guardian mentality. And too often, embracing the warrior mentality means rejecting the guardian mentality. And you really need the positive aspects of both in order to ensure that we are having policing fulfill the protect and serve nature of their mission. Let me turn it back to Joe with that statement.
And again, I appreciate that question, Pettis, and Dr. Bernays' response as well to it. Unfortunately, labels are used across this country for a variety of things. And the label of warrior, the label of guardian is out there. And clearly in communities, some departments have taken on almost of an occupying force approach. And in other communities, it's not that. As an organization, as an industry, I think it's important that this industry of policing, the industry of criminal justice in the United States has to be looked more as that of a guardian. Now, as Dr. Bernays just said a minute ago, you want a sense of protection as well in those communities. Like we're saying, violence is increasing. Communities need to feel safe. But when you're over-policing possibly in an area, that's not commensurate with the demographics of that area. You have to ask your question, why is that happening? Is it happening because certain value sets are not there by the individuals involved in that over-policing? And that's where this type of a conversation, that's where these type of strategies that the Institute is suggesting is so vital and important. Because even within the 21st Century Policing Report, that theme, that label, that idea of moving from a warrior to a guardian was prescient throughout that document. And the need to make that shift, the need to change the culture, if you will, of policing, so that communities are not looked, I mean, I think many of us can look back in some of our areas and growing up, there were certain officers on the street, you knew, and I grew up in Philadelphia, there were certain officers on the street, you wanted to stay as far away from as possible growing up, and there were others that were more embracing, that were more protective of us as young kids in those communities. And so to the extent we can get communities having to, as a part of reimagining public safety or reimagining policing in their communities, of that of a guardian by implementing some of the strategies, Pettis, that you spoke to earlier, like with mental health issues, that helps from a guardian set. That helps drive that kind of a concept for people to understand it.
It seems to me that the idea of warrior or guardian, I agree that it has two roles in policing, or that policing does encompass both of those roles, but it's really a mental construct that people have to work with. And yeah, if there are other things that are going along, Bill spoke about the anti-racism aspects of this. I know in the community where I live, if I'm in the city, there is one type of policing that goes on. If I'm in the county, there's another type of policing that goes on, and it has a lot to do, it's stemming from what I'm hearing from police chiefs, but also one area is more liberal, quote unquote, than another area. So we're really talking about reshaping thinking of people, and that's the kind of work that I do as well in my diversity work. It's how do we get people to make that shift and to accept their neighbor as a decent human being.
Correct.
And moving away from what Bill was talking about in terms of, you know, if you can create in somebody's mind that that someone else is a threat, then they're going to respond and behave as though that person is a threat. And I think that from my perspective, that's a lot of what I see. Do either of you want to comment on that before we go to break?
Just very quickly, I mean, to your point, when you think about policing in America, we suggest that it's a protect and serve mentality, is that should be involved. And it's that serve part, okay, is where you're getting more into that guardian, if you would, construct, that guardian concept. Because far too often, and again, policing can do no more, no less than communities want it to do in those communities. The citizens drive, to a large degree, the actions that a police department will take, or the type of police department that that community wants. So if that community is saying we want a more service-oriented public safety entity to be our police force, that's what you will have, because you'll develop your laws more appropriately to drive that, as far as hiring individuals that have that type of culture as a part of their DNA. So if a person that's a part of their DNA of that warrior, that they're just going to come and over-police and be abusive in communities, that's not good for the industry at all. That's not pretty good for the country at all. That's not good for the community at all. So communities have to be, they have to drive it. And they control that through their budgets. They control that through who they hire to be that chief executive officer to deal with enforcement activities in those communities. And that's where you got to get back to communities understanding that you have a big play, you have a big say in what policing needs to look like in your community.
Yeah, I teach leaders that they have to be willing to take the first step. And I think that many people are afraid of the police or don't know how to approach the police. And it's helpful, I think, when you have officers who engage the community, as we were talking about. Absolutely. with community policing. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this interview? Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you and your friends can listen for free on your favorite podcast platforms such as Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many others. I'm your host, Dr. Pettis Perry.
Join KSQD tonight at 6 p.m. for Becoming Muslim, produced by The Spiritual Edge. Becoming Muslim explores the motivations and challenges of converts on their uniquely American path of being Muslim. Hear about four people who have converted to Islam and how it has shaped their lives. How do they fit into the spiritual landscape of America? And how do they fit into a religion that's often partitioned by nationality and culture? Join us Sunday at 6 p.m. here at KSQD 90.7 FM and online at ksqd.org. Many voices, one station. Back to you, Pettis.
Thanks, Emily. Today, our topic is, can police move from a warrior mentality to a guardianship mindset? We're speaking with Dr. Joseph McMillan, past president for the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and Dr. William Denay, who developed the Polarities of Democracy theory. Learn more at the Institute for PolaritiesofDemocracy.org website. Joe and Bill, we are coming towards the end of our hour. This has been a fascinating hour. Time has really flown by. I want to ask one question, and if I could get I wanted to spend more time on it, but if I could get a brief answer. You know, we've been looking at what's happening in Ukraine with Russia and authoritarianism in the United States and globally. You know, how is there a connection between all of these dynamics that we're seeing in our communities and what we're seeing more broadly globally? I don't know which of you would like to tackle that.
I'll jump in. I see that in my mind a very strong connection between all of these, and it is the struggle for democracy. Democracy is under attack, whether it's here at home in the U.S. or whether it's in the Ukraine. And it's different actors in different places, but always driven by values that are in conflict with the polarities of democracy, the freedom and justice, diversity and equality, just human rights and communal obligations, participation and representation. We need to understand how these 10 values work together. We need to look at them and analyze them and put them to work for all people. Here in America, for 40 years, we've been on a path towards more and more benefits for the rich and the powerful, and less for the average citizen. We need to look at that and get back to that and understand that forces around the world and here at home who are want to impose their will on others can be aligned in authoritarian purposes. And so definitely in my mind, while it might be different actors, the battle and the struggle is exactly the same wherever we're at.
Thanks for that. Well, we're down to about 5 or 6 minutes, and we always like to ask our guests to talk about what people should be doing, stop doing, and start doing. So, Joe, do you want to tackle that first?
Sure. One of the things that communities and people should be doing is holding the industry of policing and the criminal justice community accountable. And that's done, again, at that grassroots level. Communities have a responsibility, and people have a responsibility to deserve and expect fair and equitable policing and enforcement of laws in their communities. And the way that that happens is by holding the industry itself accountable. One of the things, again, that we, and you're going to hear this theme again from me, stopping We need to stop by not holding these communities accountable. And because to the extent that community ensures that it's hiring and retaining those officers or those individuals involved in the criminal justice system in their communities that are going to embrace the various value sets that Dr. Bernay and I have been discussing that the Institute believes is essential in a democracy. And until we stop not holding those institutions accountable, after all is said and done, more will be said than done. And things will continue, unfortunately, in a negative direction. And again, we need to just keep advocating for policing and criminal justice reform in this country. We have the community and the nation at large has a capability to help make this shift. The industry of policing, the industry of criminal justice will not reform itself by itself. The community is a part of that conversation. Citizens are a part of that conversation. And when we're talking about a democratic society, these are 10 essential values that we've discussed today are so important to ensuring that we have departments and agencies functioning in a way that we can, in fact, make for more fair and equitable enforcement of issues across this country.
Outstanding. I've been sitting here thinking about warrior and guardian, which is another polarity that should, I guess, be talked about. Bill, your thoughts in these closing minutes?
Obviously, I'm an advocate for that we should be making the promise of democracy a reality for all people. We need to stop believing in crazy conspiracies and following false prophets like Tucker Carlson. And we need to start really engaging at a deeper level in the participatory nature of democracy. We all know that we've been told that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And unless people are willing to become more engaged in really looking deeply at the real forces that are crafting conditions of inequality in America and understanding what we need to do collectively to regain the power of our democracy, that is the challenge before us.
Yeah, it seems to me that we really need to rethink the idea of militarizing the police, because I think that statement, you know, bringing in armored vehicles, not to say that armored vehicles might not be necessary in, you know, some circumstances to get some really bad actors, but the kinds of military vehicles that we've seen and the using of military style uniforms, weapons, the whole thing really just complicates the issue, I think, in some communities, particularly when those items tend to be used disparately between communities. Even when the circumstances might call for a different type of response, such as the January 6th response. I was listening to he was the former Metropolitan, I guess it was the D.C. Metropolitan Police Chief, who said if the people storming the Capitol had been black and brown, they would have never made it up the stairs. And that's part of the problem, because people are watching how other people are being treated, and it complicates the dynamics when you start looking about the human behavior that's going on. People are not ignorant. They see and they feel what's going on. And I can tell you in the example I used earlier, when I'm in town, I know several of the police officers, and they are very different than the sheriff's department. And that's not to say that the sheriff's department are bad people, but you can see the difference in the way that they behave by virtue of the leadership of the departments. And this is, you know, this is one of the things that you see when you study organizational dynamics. You know, you don't have to have direct confrontation in the store to see what happens when you go into a store if you're a person of color and you're being followed. That's a statement of the leaders in that store. And it's oftentimes certainly not justified. And we've seen the outgrowth of that in terms of the disparate treatment of different people based on the color of their skin and the communities from which they come. So, Joe and Bill, I really enjoyed this conversation, and I know our radio and podcast listeners did as well. Thank you both for being our bold and impressive guests today. We appreciate you and all that you do. Thank you. Remember to visit their website, Institute for Polarities of Democracy.org. What's up next? Our Be Bold American show next will be on Sunday, April 10th at 5 p.m. to hear Jen Senko discuss her documentary and her new book, The Brainwashing of My Dad, How the Rise of the Right-Wing Media Changed a Father and Divided Our Nation, and How We Can Fight Back. Jen's father, Frank, always knew how to have a good time. But after a job change, Frank was forced to be in his car for long periods of time, and Jen noticed his lifelong personality and beliefs changed. Long hours on the road, listening to right-wing radio commentators, sucked her father into a suspicious, laden worldview dominated by conspiracy theories, fake news, and rants about the coastal elites, and you guessed it, libtards trying to destroy America. Jen wanted to know what happened to her dad. Join us on Sunday, April 10th at 5 p.m. to find out what happened to him and how she and her mother got him back to the happy person he was before. Remember, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to give a special thanks to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and to our program director, Howard Feldstein, and again, to our bold guests, Dr. William Binet and Dr. Joseph McMillan. Thank you both. You're listening to KSQD, Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Becoming Muslim, produced by The Spiritual Edge. My name is Dr. Pettus Perry. Looking forward to having Jill back next time. Thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep stop start.